Jason.
Antigonish. That's the name of the poem. Published in 1899 by Hughes Mearns. And it goes, yesterday upon the stair, I met a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. I wish he'd go away. When I came home last night at 3, the man was waiting there for me. But when I looked around the hall, I couldn't see him there at all. That was used, it was another British sci-fi series called Sapphire and Steel that was sort of like an independent reimagining of Doctor Who with David McCallum and Joanna Lumley. But they use nursery rhymes a lot.
Now, the nursery rhymes in the name of the Doctor kind of fell dead to me with the little greater intelligence guys.
Mm-hmm.
But these nursery rhymes actually,
I think because they were so dope, so applicable without being blatantly about the story. You know, like with those ones, the name of the Doctor, it was like, I don't know. This way is a little bit more, you know, darker because the Doctor is being more dark about it.
It wasn't campy feeling.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like the Doctor was scared.
Yeah, yeah.
So welcome, everybody. Dan started the podcast, which was wonderful. So time travelers, Whovians, Nuvians, boys and girls, and all variations in between. We had this episode, it was last Saturday now,
mm-hmm.
called Listen by the great and wonderful Stephen Moffat.
What? All of what we've been saying for the last 10 months,
yeah.
We just threw out the window. But
Stephen Moffat should hang his hat on this episode. And, of course, he wrote Blink.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And he wrote, what was the child episode? Are You My Mummy?
The Empty Child. And the
Empty
Doctor.
Child and the mm-hmm. Doctor Dances, yeah. So I think those are his jewels.
Yep.
I'm sure there's been a few more, but this one is definitely the best of the four so far.
I think so.
In the season.
Mm. Oh, absolutely.
At the start, we see the TARDIS doors open, get a nice screenshot of of the TARDIS, and then Capaldi's on top of the TARDIS, apparently not being bothered by the light on top of the TARDIS, because he's sitting cross-legged.
She makes accommodations. All right.
Yeah, okay. he's sitting cross-legged in a meditative pose, and he says, listen. And it's, he goes off on this rambling, he's thinking about all these different things. How do we talk out, or why do we talk out loud when we know that we're alone? Conjecture, because we know we're not alone. And he starts writing on the chalkboard.
Yep.
Evolution. Well, I would posit that it's not evolution that he meant, but natural selection.
Yeah, yeah.
Survival.
I love the chalk thing, by the way, this season.
Yeah.
This is like, it's like his, all of a sudden it's going back to the scientist thing with, you know, chalk, writing everything all over the place. It's good. I like it.
It's almost like the chalkboard is like his version of Tom Baker's scarf, you know, it's something that.
It's true. Because, yeah, actually, when you think, like, you think of the first episode and he's sniffing around the room and he found a piece of chalk laying underneath the radiator and he picked that up. Aha! He was all excited, so. You're right. It is kind of being.
Yeah, writing on
his
the walls,
scarf.
Writing on the floor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Perfect Hunters, Lions is what he chose. There's lots of examples of Perfect Hunters, I would get.
Yeah.
Wolves, I mean, they.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect defense, and this is the pufferfish.
Yeah, which I thought was kind of funny because it's not the perfect, but I guess his point was just, again, natural selection, the whole idea of just the ways that things evolve into fine-tuning their defenses as opposed to fine-tuning their offense.
Yeah, the best offense is a great defense, right?
Yeah.
And you got those, like, I don't know, those dragons that flare out their
yeah.
ears or
mm-hmm.
whatever that is.
Yeah, that part of the neck.
Neck, I guess. And then the perfect hiding is what he's wondering. And I guess there's some things that are great at hiding. I guess the silence was great at hiding for thousands and thousands of years. They're not really mentioned. The chameleon isn't really mentioned.
Vashta Narada.
Vashta Narada.
To be honest, that's what that was one of the first things I went into when he was like, but is there anything that perfects the job of hiding? And I'm like, wait a second. Or even when he's talking about, like, why do you not feel alone when you're in the dark? And I'm like, wait, did you forget what happened at the library?
Although I guess you could argue they weren't perfect because...
They defeated them.
In the end, and they were able trapped. To figure out what they were.
Yeah.
Where this is a nameless something, you know, to him that he doesn't know anything about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So, Dan, what was your attitude while watching this? What were you feeling? Take us through your emotional and mental process when you're watching this. Did you know that it was going to be, like, the best episode of the season or the best...
Well, from the trailer where he was reciting the nursery rhyme, which I guess we'll be playing later on, I knew it was going to be a scary episode. And I, being a fan of horror in general, or you know, particularly old school horror, ghost stories for me too have like a special resonance in me. So I actually found last year's ghost story episode.
The Hide.
Which I forget the name of.
The Hide.
Hide, yeah. I thought that was very good. Mm-hmm. And
I guess it's Hide, not the
it's
Hide.
It's just Hide, yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
You know.
Yeah.
And so I was expecting, you know, Cross. Like a Steve Moffat, like scary, you know, scary monster kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
And that delivered. I actually felt, and I think this is tribute to the director who I'm now looking up. Douglas McKinnon was the director, and I thought that his directing was excellent. The way the scary scenes were shot were actually, I found myself, you know, really drawn in and caught up in the creepiness of the episode. And there was like a little extra thing that you could stream online after the episode aired. And the director talked about how he wanted to use sound in the episode as well, and use sound as a form of adding creepiness. And that to me makes me think of like the video game Silent Hill that used a lot of sound.
It's all Silent Hill is all about ambience and the sounds that were made. I mean, you know, especially when you consider like Silent Hill 2, you know. Predominantly, most of the time, you heard the creatures coming at you before you saw anything. So, definitely had that creep factor.
And just the way that he would incorporate, like organic sound, like human sounds, into sounds of like non-organic things, like doors closing and stuff like that. He would put in like you know sounds that humans make or human voices, kind of slip them in. And I thought that really built the atmosphere very well.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny that you mentioned that. There is certain movies that are very memorable to me that do that little thing. Eli Wallach played Tuco Benedicto Juan Ramirez Pacifico in The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. And while he was torturing Clint Eastwood in the desert and just letting him walk with him while he had the umbrella in the water, and Clint Eastwood didn't have any of that, you could hear him breathing, laughing under his breath at certain times, and the volume was turned up on his breathing, and it was very well done. And it always gave him, even though he wasn't a sinister character, what he was doing was very sinister, and he was getting such a charge out of himself that it always kind of stuck with me.
Yeah, that's very good too. Should I mention The Haunting? Which I just did, so I guess I will.
Go for it.
there's a scene in Listen where...
Now you're talking about the original Haunting, right? Not to get confused
with...
Yeah,
the original Haunting from 1963, directed by Robert Wise. Classic ghost, or haunted house, not so much ghost, but a haunted house story. And there's a scene in it where the main character is being terrorized by the house... And she's hiding in her bedroom behind the door, and the door, and all this stuff is like banging on the door, and the door is shaking. And there's a point the movie where the door kind of bows in and starts getting pushed in by something. And it's all sound related. You never actually see anything. And like listen, you never really see anything. It's all in the sound. It's all people talking. It's what they're saying, but it is. It's very sound heavy.
Hmm. Which makes it even scarier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, we've had that discussion where something that you don't see, like Psycho, you know, scene is so much more freaky when your imagination takes over than something like, I don't know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Evil Dead, or...
Well, even the, I mean, well, I guess as much of a scary movie as it was, but even like the original Children of the Corn, you know, like
I wasn't impressed with that.
Yeah. I just know, like, the later ones, they started trying to introduce where you could see the monster, and it took all of the creep factor away, you know, what existed in the first one. Not that it's...
It's very dated, that Children of the Corn, when you watch it now, you're like, oh my God, 70s.
Yeah. No, now it's not scary just because of the fact that so many people have kind of reinvented it and done the same kind of thing so many times now that it just doesn't
like,
have the impact.
Well, that's like Omen. It was supposed to be scary, and yet at the same time, I think there was only like the scene where in the beginning where the person hung themselves out the window was like the only thing that was actually a little freaky.
Or how about even Rosemary's Baby? I mean, how creepy was that? That your mom still talks about the fact that she's only seen the movie once, but it was so scary for her. Now it's like, okay.
I don't know. I kind of always knew what was going to happen in that because I just have a sick mind.
I guess. Well, that, and like I said, it's also just the presentation is dated now. When you see
other
things,
because there's other movies that's been spun off from that, and that there are satanic cults and things in other movies, and so you knew what was going on.
Yeah.
Because you were clued in because of stuff that's more recent.
Right, right.
Sorry, Dan.
I know, like, one of my friends actually...
I think this was a lot
scarier.
Watching
last week's episode, he quoted H.P. Lovecraft as saying, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the quote in front of me, but it basically, man's greatest fear is fear of the unknown.
Right.
And I think that really applies strongly in Listen, you know, it's not knowing.
Yeah, I think there were some things, too, in it, which I think we've talked about it before, but the Ring, to me, is one of, like, the remake, not Ringu, the Japanese version, but which is fantastic in itself. But the thing about the newer version that was, you know, the American version was that, like, the stuff that they did with that, like you said, again, it's so much about sound. It's not necessarily that the images by themselves would be disturbing, but the sounds, like the stuff from the tape, like if you what was supposed to actually be the tape, like that in itself is far more disturbing than, you know, the girl they find in the closet, because just because of the way it's done with the sound and the quick imagery, and, you know, there are things you can see in your daily life. Like, you know, like there are things from that.
And it was done in black and white.
Yes, the tape was in black and white, exactly.
Which makes it even creepier.
Right, because you're subconsciously projecting the color into it. So, you know, it's like including your mind into it, since that's black and white and everything else is color. So your mind is naturally trying to colorize it. But then, like I said, there are so many things, you know, the close-up shot of the horse's eye, you know, which it's not that hard for people to be able to see in real life, and just some of the other things. I've been walking around at the mall, and I say, whoa, that's weird. That's like, look down that hallway, honey. That right there, what's going on, is exactly one of the stills from the tape in The Ring. So
7 days.
Yep.
So to get back... I'm sorry, Dan.
I'm sorry. Still on The Ring tangent. I do admit, when I saw the girl in the closet and her mouth was all like... That kind of like freaked me out.
Well, no, but that's because it was so like... half a second worth of, like, here, you can see it real quick, and we're going to take it away.
A split second, it was there.
Yeah, that's what I mean, exactly. It was so fast that, like, you couldn't help but get the image stuck in your head. It was almost like a subconscious thing more than a sit and look at.
Go eat popcorn.
Yeah, and it was... But I agree. That was, like, when I first saw the movie, I almost had to turn it off right there, just because I was like, if the whole movie is going to be like that, where it just blasts these images at you, like, I was like, this might be a little bit much. But... when you muscle through it, it's a great movie anyway. I don't care if it's a remake. It's good.
So, to get back to the story. Nah, it's all relevant. Just because of the creep factor. I love the... now, he thinks that everyone's had this dream at some point in their lives. This exact same nightmare where we step down from our bed and someone...
a hand grabs our ankle.
Right.
And...
And actually, I did some research on it, and I have seen this dream now online. And there's some images of like a monster grabbing. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, it is the same ankle. It's the left ankle.
It's always the left ankle.
Yeah. I don't know why. Clara is a left-hander. And so you see on each one of the people in Listen, it looks like her hand every time.
Hmm.
And so I tried to freeze it and see her the way her knuckles are. Everything. It looks like Clara did it on every one of them to remain consistent.
That's cool.
I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what it looked like. And there's something called, here, 1 second, let me pull it up. Something called a hypnagogic jerk.
It would be hypnagogic, yeah.
Hypnagogic. And there's another pronunciation of it as well. I don't think I have it down here. But it's an involuntary twitch or a muscle contraction that occurs while an individual is beginning to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. There may be a sensation of falling followed by a physical jerk back into wakefulness. It usually occurs during stage one sleep, which is the lightest stage of sleep. And I've had this, and it's called a hypnic jerk as well.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a recurring dream where I'm just about to fall asleep, and I'm standing on the side of a street corner, and my heel falls off of the street corner and into the street just a little bit, where it's just a snapping jerk where I lose grip of my heel from my – it doesn't matter which foot it is. I believe it's my right foot because I'm a right-hander, and so I'm more focused, right eye, right hand, all that. And I haven't had it in a while, but it's something that I wake up from immediately, and I snap back awake, and I actually my head comes off the pillow. It's very similar to this, is where they say that they're dreaming, they wake up, but they don't wake up; they're still asleep.
Hmm. Yeah, it's weird because I know as far as the hypnagogic jerk, the whole idea of stage one sleep and like shaking yourself awake. I have it all the time. Like, I mean, you know, I'll be just about past asleep, or I'll have just fallen asleep, and like my leg will kick, you know, or whatever. Like, and yeah, it'll wake me right back up.
Yeah, that I get the shudders sometimes too, a muscle convulsion.
Well, exactly, like a muscle spasm. The muscle will just contract and let go by itself, kind of suddenly.
But and I was also reading that some people this happens, and that they feel like their legs are being pulled from the bed if they sleep too close to the edge of the bed.
Right, their leg will feel like they're getting pulled.
They're
off
getting
the
pulled
edge
from something.
Oh wow,
yeah.
That's interesting.
Because I've never really had this dream. Have you had this dream, Dan? Where are you
grabbing my ankle? No, not that I'm aware of.
All right, so within the story, we have the Danny Pink and Clara story as well. So, essentially, take us through. Take us through what Danny and Clara's relationship is, and with the potential for this other person that they meet.
Well, basically, they have, there's a lot they kind of tried to start putting together, I think, in this episode. But at this point, primarily, Danny and Clara, just they're both teachers at Coal Hill, which Ian and Barbara were teaching at when they came across Susan and got tied up with the doctor. But, basically, Danny and Clara, as they kind of started into the Dalek, they're interested in dating. So they decide they're going to go off on a date, and Clara gets upset with the doctor because she's trying to have a date, and he keeps showing up saying, we're going to go on this adventure now, because he's in the middle of this process of trying to understand the dream and all that. Just to say at the least, the date is not going that well. So the whole episode is just kind of the process of them back and forth, bickering a little bit and cleaning it up and going back and forth. And I don't know how much further you want me to go with that at this point, but
no, that's fine. It's just interesting too how they have the most awkward conversation at this date.
Yeah.
And
I guess when watching it, I was kind of like watching it. I'm like, this is just horrible because it's. Watching the two of them going back and forth, I was like, they look almost like they've been married for 15 years, and they're tired of it. Like, that's almost more like what the date looked like to me. It was a couple that's already having a hard time. Like, you know, being on edge with each other, like waiting for the next thing the other one says just so that they can be offended by it. That's kind of almost what was happening.
When arguing and fighting becomes the normal way to
communicate. They're just waiting for the next thing to be said so that they can counter, you know, when the next time they're up for speaking. And I was frustrated with it because I was thinking, like, first off, I just thought it was ridiculous, the comment Clara makes that initially gets Danny upset. And
right.
Then his reaction
what
to
was
it.
The comment?
And,
I could kill that girl sometimes, she says. And then,
and that's easy for you.
And that's why he says, because she knows that he killed, apparently, being a soldier.
Presumably.
And so he was saying, no, I've dug wells. I dug 23 wells. You people.
Right.
Saying when he says you people, that raises her hackles.
Yeah.
And tries to defend soldiery. And he's like, soldiery isn't what you people think it is.
Right.
You know, essentially. So
because not all soldiers are necessarily involved in carrying weapons and shooting people. You know, there are some that are stationed and, you know, do humanitarian aid their whole service. But.
All right. So we get to the point where Clara can actually fly the TARDIS. Now, here again, Clara, I think, did a really good job. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be positive with Jenna Louise. I think Clara is starting to develop as a character, and I'm very happy where she's going. Past the impossible girl baloney.
Mm-hmm.
Past the doctor's inquisitiveness about her.
Mm-hmm. Past her semi-infatuation that she doesn't want to admit
right.
to. You know,
so that she can move on and develop as a character. And so I think she's doing very well in that regard. So far this season. Now, she uses the TARDIS's telepathic interface circuits. This isn't really a new thing. What can you think of, Dan, when the TARDIS is telepathic?
Just in terms of general?
Yeah, like it's
or
kind
in terms of like,
yeah, just in general.
I mean, well, you know, the ability for people to understand any language, basically. It's the That's through the TARDIS.
And also, there was an episode, Time Monster. John Pertwee, and when Roger Delgado was the master. And Joe Grant asks him about the TARDIS, and the TARDISes are telepathic, and he says, of course they are. How else do you think they communicate? So TARDISes themselves can communicate with other mm-hmm. TARDIS. Tardi? No, it
well,
would still be
know.
TARDISes.
At the same time, the one thing I always pick on about that is that if Susan named the TARDIS TARDIS, then why is every TARDIS a TARDIS?
Well, yeah.
But
that's,
anyway.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, even the generating rooms, didn't the Doctor once, I think as Peter Davison say, that
yes.
that it generates rooms based on the need? So like it kind of presupposes, like it understands the situation and will
mm-hmm.
kind of...
It's like Howl's Moving Castle.
Yeah, exactly. It will kind of like telepathically understand the situation and expand itself or contract itself.
So the Time Lords are telepathic as well, and we see that plenty of times with the Master. We see it with Susan, the Doctor's granddaughter. And the Doctor mentions his family in this.
Yep.
We see it in the Sensorite episodes with Susan. The girl in the fireplace, we see the whole mind meld thing going on with Madame de Pompadour.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Lodger episode, when Matt Smith like bashes his head into Craig.
Yep.
To give him this like transference of knowledge and his experience multiple times.
Well, even Vastra in Deep Breath. The whole sharing each other's thoughts to make him go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really neat that she's hooked in, and then the TARDIS doesn't really want to let her go. She has to actually pull out of it, which was, I think, it was cool because how often does the TARDIS get to actually touch?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I thought it was neat, too, that, you know, even back in Hyde, where when the TARDIS presented itself to Clara, that its interface was Clara. You know, like, even back then, like, the TARDIS has something for Clara, whether it's on whatever level. But, you know, there's something about Clara that the TARDIS has associated itself to, like, you know, multiple times now.
Clara asks in this episode, is it bad if I meet myself? And the Doctor says it's potentially catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
And that immediately made me think of all the classic episodes where...
Oh, yeah. Paradoxes and all that. Yep.
And the Brigadier in Mordrum dead.
Yeah. What would he call Peter Davison? Some kind of effect. I forget what it was called.
Yeah, I don't know. Different times, the Brigadier was 6 years different, but he went up to himself almost like a mirror and touched his hand to his hand, and there was the explosion that actually helped the episode, saved the Doctor from having his all his regeneration sucked out by these Maudrin. But it's always been kind of forgotten about, except when Rose almost touched baby Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's kind of been forgotten because there has been points.
Well, wasn't even with Amy and old Amy, the girl who waited.
Yes.
Wasn't there even, it was brought up again with that episode, wasn't it? I'm just trying to think.
No,
because
I don't remember.
They saw each other, but I don't remember if they, I don't think they actually touched each other, and I don't remember if the Doctor made a point not to. But
yeah,
they were face to face, so.
It's the Blinovich limitation effect.
I didn't know it had that name. I've never heard of that. Where was that? TARDIS data core? DARTIS. I'm really going weird with
DARTIS.
TARDIS. Retardis. I'm sorry. That's bad.
According to this, it is usually understood as having two aspects. Firstly, that a time traveler cannot redo an act that he has previously committed. And secondly, that a dangerous energy discharge will result of two temporal versions of the same person coming into contact. The first aspect is similar to real-world physics conjecture, the Novikov self-consistency principle. That's interesting.
Which makes sense, because it probably clashes with the whole idea of things being set, because you figure if in the future you have to make the decision to touch your own hand in the past, then you have to always expect that to happen. Otherwise, that would break something.
But it never really applies to the Doctor, because he's been around himself many different times.
He's a Time Lord. That's different, though.
So, moving on.
But even he has said, though, like, if he was to run into himself, it could cause problems. But then he's done it, and it hasn't been a problem. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe
the
if it's
Lords
only...
have actually arranged for him to do it.
Yeah.
To solve something.
Well, not make a point about all 13 being there together, but...
Anyway, they end up in this home for children, because... The phone rings, and Clara's...
trying to ignore that it's Danny Pink
on
the phone.
Yes, and she sees the wave from Danny in her mind's eye. And so they end up at this home, and Clara sneaks upstairs and finds Rupert Pink, who is Danny Pink, as a young boy. And the Doctor has a pretty interesting conversation with the guardian, or the person, in the Night Watch person. About his coffee and about the telly just went off. And then the Doctor steals his coffee in like a split second and walks up. It was very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I dug that. At first I was thinking like, oh, here we go. Another horror, like, you know, haunted house story. I'm like, oh wait, he's just playing with his sonic screwdriver.
And then we have Clara trying to reassure Rupert. And then that thing comes up on the bed. And then the thing is like in a grandma's crocheted kind of red blanket. Very, very creepy when it's just sitting there covered up. Can't see the face.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting, too, is when the amount of weight that was on the bed, like by whatever it was, like the mattress sunk very low for the size of whatever it was when, by the time you saw it standing behind them. Like when you put that together, you think like, wow, it was very heavy but very small. Because the mattress is almost like, you know, probably about 4 inches off of the floor with whatever it was on it. So, you know,
it looked like
heavy.
One of those old military cots.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty much.
So the Doctor, all of a sudden turns the light on, and to go back to something that you said earlier about the inquisitiveness, about, him wanting to know what the hiding things were,
right. What
happens?
He ignores it, which is what I don't understand. Because, you know...
What do you mean by he ignores
it?
Well... Explain to
he
the
doesn't,
people.
Yeah, he doesn't ignore it. But, you know, we mentioned in the beginning of the episode, his whole... basically frustration during his study that he's doing. You know, he's trying to study the whole thing about, you know, the perfect hunter, the perfect defender, and now he's looking to find information on the perfect hider. And, you know, he goes and gets Clara specifically to help him with an experiment and all that kind of stuff. And they're going through time because they're trying to go to a place where somebody's having the dream of their ankle being grabbed from something under the bed, just so that he can witness it and to study it. But by the time they get there, maybe that's the point, maybe because this wasn't exactly the dream that he was trying to study, but when they're in the room and the thing is on the bed, they're facing the window because the doctor tells Rupert, right, don't look at it. Close your eyes. Make sure you turn around. Look at the window.
And then he has
don't look at the reflection.
Quote, my favorite quote in the thing, the deep and lovely dark, we never see the stars without it.
Yeah.
And I love the way he said it. Uh-huh. It was almost like a Vincent Price kind of quality to
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah, he totally just kind of went off on like a, even in the midst of whatever's going on, like he he had his time in his head where he could just stop and just all of a sudden look at how dark it was outside and look up at the sky. But again, the problem that I found with this is that he was doing all this work trying to study this thing that was great at hiding, as if he's not the doctor who studies weird occurrences anyway. But then when the thing is on the bed and it gets off the bed and it's standing right behind them, he tells them to close their eyes and don't look at it. Maybe it'll go away.
You think he was more concerned with Rupert and Clara than if he was alone? If he was alone? Yeah.
Especially because Rupert was, because he was supposed to be going and seeing Clara as a kid.
Right.
Having a dream. And
he also told Clara to stay in the TARDIS and she didn't listen to him. So,
yeah,
you know, maybe that was part of it. You know, that just the fact that she was there.
If he pulled the blanket down and something, it didn't want to be hidden anymore. It is obviously making itself very known and large in the room.
Right. Right. And that's what's kind of, it was just strange, though, that there wasn't even any kind of expression from the doctor. That he was frustrated that the thing he was there to study got away. It was just, he was almost excited that, like, don't look at it because it might just go away. And when it did go away, he was like, okay, we're okay now.
Well, he does make some coy remarks, and Clara kind of slaps him a little bit upside the head. And then, because Clara is more concerned about Rupert being okay, and so she takes out this box of soldiers, and she says, you see this one? This is a soldier so brave, he doesn't need a gun.
Yep.
Which was like the doctor
mm-hmm.
has always been.
Yep. And then trying to put him to sleep. You know, read me a bedtime story. Here's a great story.
Once upon a time, the end.
Puts him to sleep.
Dad skills.
Yep.
Which again goes back to Susan, his granddaughter, and Patrick Troughton's comment about having his family right behind his eyes. And they're there when
I need them. I just need to call them up. Yep.
And trying to make Victoria feel better. And that was in...
Tomb of the Cybermen.
Yes, Tomb. Mm-hmm. Very good, Dan. You've watched Doctor Who before.
Yeah, I watched it recently. So
2 years ago.
So recently is 2 years. We've established this in Dan Dan's timeline. So Clara lies about knowing Rupert Pink, Danny Pink.
About not knowing him. She insists to the doctor that she doesn't have any tie with him.
But the doctor asks personal questions too. The doctor's smarter than all that.
Oh, of course.
So he knows.
I like the whole line where he asks who she went on a date with. And he's like, are you attempting conversation? He's like, yeah, I figure I'd give it a shot.
Yeah.
And so basically what we have with Dan the Soldier Man, if you'll play the audio clip from that. About the dream, the doctor.
Doctor talking to Rupert?
Yeah. Oh, no, this is about fear. The dream.
Dream about Dan Soldier.
Yeah.
Will he remember any of that?
Scrambled his memory. Gave him a big old dream about being Dan the Soldier Man.
I love Soldier.
It's I love his voice.
Such a Scottish, like...
And I love the smile on his face because he's so pleased with himself. And then he sees Clara's reaction where she's gone all eyeballs. It's like, your eyes are out of control. Get them under control.
Yeah, I got a kick out of that.
She has to have three mirrors.
Her head is so wide. Well, that's what's funny, too, is that when they were having the whole conversation earlier about how like people made fun about how wide her head was at dinner with Danny. And then the doctor, they're out of nowhere. Her head is so wide, she needs three mirrors.
Can you just turn your head?
I didn't catch that till the second time I watched it. I didn't catch the joke resurfacing again. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
So what happens, he does tell Danny, and we'll get to this audio clip as well. He does tell Danny about fear. If you'll play that audio clip, it ties in with the end of the episode, which is the Twilight Zone shocker.
Are you scared? The thing on the bed, whatever it is, look at it. Does it scare you?
Yes.
Well, that's good. You want to know why that's good?
Why?
Let me tell you about scared. Your heart is beating so hard. I can feel it through your hands. There's so much blood and oxygen pumping through your brain. It's like rocket fuel. Right now, you could run faster and you could fight harder. You could jump higher than ever in your life. And you are so alert. It's like you can slow down time. What's wrong with scared? Scared is a superpower. It's your superpower. There is danger in this room. And guess what? It's you. Do you feel it? Do you think he feels it? Do you think he's scared? Yeah. Loser.
Slow down time.
Yeah, that was my favorite part of that whole monologue.
And when he sounds like a Dalek.
Yeah.
He does the whole Dalek kind of impersonation about fear.
Yeah. Yep.
And what is that? That is the exact thing that Clara tells him when Clara is hiding under the bed.
Yep.
And so Clara first hears it from him. Then he first hears it from Clara.
Yep. Yep. And not only that, but the soldier. Keep in mind, the soldier without the gun is the same soldier that she leaves the doctor. So do you realize that that soldier without the gun, that's the doctor gave that to her for him.
Right, because that's who he becomes, because he was scared to go into the academy.
Right, he was scared of the dark, so he was out in the barnyard, the barn, and, you know, well, we'll get more into it as the episode progresses. But
now play what Clara says to the doctor, the young doctor in the barn. Or maybe it's not the doctor. We don't really know that. They only implicitly say that.
Listen. This is just a dream. But very clever people can hear dreams. So please just listen. I know you're afraid. But being afraid is all right. Because didn't anybody ever tell you? Fear is a superpower. Fear can make you faster and cleverer and stronger. And one day, you're going to come back to this barn, and on that day, you're going to be very afraid indeed. That's okay, because if you're very wise and very strong, fear doesn't have to make you cruel or cowardly. Fear can make you kind.
No, no, not the hugging. No, 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 I'm against the hugging.
I know. It doesn't matter if there's nothing under the bed or in the dark, so long as you know it's okay to be afraid of it.
I just get nervous.
Me too.
Well, I don't even know what I'm nervous of.
I'll show you. So listen. If you listen to nothing else, listen to this. You're always going to be afraid. Even if you learn to hide it, fear is like a companion, a constant companion, always there. But that's okay, because fear can bring us together. Fear can bring you home. I'm gonna leave you something just so you'll always remember. Fear makes companions of us all.
Thoughts, Dan? Is her voice putting you to sleep?
No.
You look very placid.
It's like a soothingness, like a motherly quality. It's intentional, like the way she's speaking to him,
yeah,
and reassuring him. And it is, you know, like a mother reassuring their scared child, you know, who just had a nightmare. But I find that it's great that like you said, you know, it's like he tells little Rupert, but she's the one that told him. But the reason that she told him is because she heard him tell Rupert. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, Steve Moffat likes to do, and he does it very well. Especially when he really does it well, he like really nails it. And it is. I mean, and you know, it's also about her and her date going horribly wrong, and the fear of making friends, the fear of, on the first date, you know, it's always, you don't know what's going to, you know, is it going to go good? And the scare of liking someone and not being sure if they feel the same way, you know, that's all tied in, you know? So, but I think that ties everything in the episode up very well.
Rob, what did you?
That's when I lost it, pretty much. That's when I got all choked up. Just her whole thing of, you know, in one day you're going to come back here, and when they show John hurt, and I was thinking to myself, I was like, holy crap, she's in the barn. They are in the barn right now that he goes back to when he's making the decision that he has to destroy everything. And that's when right there all of a sudden I was like, wow.
That, like, was his place of, like, security.
Like Dan said, like, Stephen Moffat did it right. Like, he knew exactly what pieces to put together to, like, make that perfect. Because I'm like a sucker for, like, epics, and the way that the season's been going so far, like, I felt like it's just like, okay, this is nice, this is a new season, whatever. But then all of a sudden, like, the last, like, 3 years' worth of Stephen Moffat's efforts started to make a lot more sense, I guess. At least it felt more tied together. And just, like I said, just strictly the whole thing of, like, when she climbs under the bed and he puts his foot down, she grabs his ankle, I was like, the dream is the doctor's dream, and he's made other people have it because he was so terrified by it. Like, I don't know how he would do that unless it just ties into Clara's being sharded throughout, you know. All That's with a D. That's not with a T. When she was split up and
yes,
spread apart. Okay, I think we're going to have to do some editing.
No, but... no, that's wonderful. I... Now I'm envisioning it. Oh, Lord. Well, let me talk for a second. Stop it. Just let me talk. It made me think of, it was, first of all, it was a whole Twilight Zone ending for me, which was absolutely perfect because you don't see Stephen Moffat right out of his mind very often. And he tied not only this, not only John Hurt, not only the ankle, he tied in John Pertwee's regeneration into Tom Baker. John Pertwee says during his regeneration, if I remember the quote correctly, that I had to overcome my fear, Sarah, that it was more important than continuing on. Mm-hmm. And that's when he had his arm, she had his arm, and then it went limp.
Mm-hmm.
And she closed his eyes. So I saw a meme from the Cave of Skulls from the Unearthly Child episode when they're with the cavemen and stuff, and the doctor saying, the William Hartnell doctor saying, fear makes companions of us all.
Mm.
So he's bringing in all this beautiful other interwebbing of the Doctor.
And that's even the whole... Yeah, and that's
the series, over 50 years. And he really wrote out of his mind, and I am just so impressed when an episode works.
Right. And that's the thing, too. Like, just the fact that, you know, like, we've gotten little hints every once in a while over time about, like, the Doctor's past, his family, and things like that. And so then the fact that, like, which we didn't have in the clip, but Clara makes a point about the Doctor just being a scared little boy, like, just looking for comfort. Like, all of a sudden I was like, you know, I started picturing not just this episode, but I started picturing, you know, Colin Baker, the times where he was frustrated and upset, or Tom Baker, the times that he looked distraught, or even all the Doctors that we've had, and just the times where you saw that they were close to their companions, and all of a sudden I pictured this little boy scared in his bed, you know, sleeping in the barn because he was scared of maybe the noises that his house made during the night. And just to think that, like, this is that person. This is the same person.
We see him, like, as a young child in another one, too, when he and the Master look into the Eye of Harmony.
Right. Yep. Yeah, during the graduation ceremony or whatever their choosing ceremony thing that they had.
Right. It's almost like the fairy ring. You know, if you go into the other world, some people come back and they're crazy. Some come back as poets. And they take from that folklore as looking into the Eye of Harmony, meaning going into the other world or the spirit world in that way.
Yep.
More or less.
Mm-hmm.
We also have the whole knocking at the door, which is very important at working with this episode, because they go back to Orson Pink's. I thought his name was Awesome, the way
that they were saying. I kept thinking he was saying Awesome too, and I was like, Awesome Pink, and I was like, what?
Yeah, a lot of people thought that. Even on the forums, they thought that he was Awesome
Colonel
Pink.
Awesome Pink. But and the Doctor mentions, so if nothing's beyond the door, why is it locked?
Mm-hmm.
And just to think that this is the edge of eternity. This is, he's the last man on Earth. And my wife came up with something that she remembered from a Frederick Brown's The Knock. Short story, and the quote goes, "The last man on Earth sat alone in a room. There was a knock at the door."
Hmm.
Just to go along with what Dan was saying about night terrors, for the most part, about someone standing in the doorway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it dreams, when you mix memory with dream, as taken from Charles DeLint, you don't know if it's a dream memory or if it's a real life memory sometimes. And thinking about the other episode where the Doctor actually calls himself the Dream Lord, this version of the Doctor, this little man in the Matt Smith, Rory, and Amy episode. What was the name of the episode? I'm not quite sure of. Amy's Choice?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Knocking at the Door. So are these a real thing, a real thing that are good at hiding, or are these, as was suggested, ghosts? Or are these dreams? Because I don't think that was actually fleshed out very well.
I think it was meant to be ambiguous. Because every supernatural moment in the story is also given a rational explanation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the thing on the bed could have just been one of the
kids.
You almost
go backtrack and say there was no monster. That it was all because the Doctor had a dream and Clara grabbed his ankle. That it planted the seed, you know, in his mind.
Mm-hmm. And then they do show, you know, the thing on the bed. You know, they say maybe it's just one of the other kids playing a joke. You know, and they do show the face after whatever it was pulls the blanket off. And you can see it's a face with eyes and stuff.
Yeah, it's sort of a weird reflection, almost like a Santarin kind of Potato Head thing
they
going
had,
on.
There was a glare from the light that was behind its head. So it looks like it has an odd shape.
Yeah.
And it's also not in focus because of the distance between it and Rupert and Clara and the Doctor, which were in focus in the foreground. So I think it's another one of those things where, kind of like the ring, they leave it. They let you see that it's like a person, you know, you see the eyes and stuff, and, you know, you hear it run away and the door slams. So I guess maybe they're trying to say, we're going to leave it up to interpretation, but generally the idea is it was another kid playing around. But yeah, I think, like Dan was saying too, though, but there's also the, you know, basically everything has a reasonable, logical explanation. You know, it's not all left up to being supernatural, if you will. It kind of made me think of I think it was called The Craft. It was a movie that came out a few years ago. It's like 20 years ago now, almost. It was the story about the three teenage girls
getting into witchcraft.
Yeah, they were getting into witchcraft, and they started like doing like all these, you know, things. The one girl had burns, and they were trying to do things, whatever you want to call it, you know, incantations and stuff, so she would get healed. But they showed that she was at the same time going for medical procedure, and there were one or two. Basically, they were saying that all the things that the girls were putting this spiritual power behind were actually being resolved by explainable like means. So to say that, like, you know, as much hope as you want to put into the supernatural aspect of it, you know, don't always expect that that's how it's going to work out. That, you know, there may be.
I think it just gave them confidence within that movie is what it did. It set them apart from the other girls in the school, and it gave them confidence that Mano was their little goddess or whatever that they were.
I forget. It's been a long time, but.
There was a part in this, too, where. Peter Capaldi wakes up from being unconscious, and he says, what's the quote, Dan, about Santarans? And it's actually very, very funny, too, because it's in the same scene that John Pertwee talks about fear when he's regenerating. And the first thing that Tom Baker says is the thing that Peter Capaldi says.
When he woke up from getting hit in the head or whatever.
Yeah.
It was... the 12th Doctor, upon waking in the TARDIS, mentions some Tarns perverting the course of human history. And it's the first words that Tom Baker says in Robot. And it references the Time Warrior, which was the first story that Sarah Jane Smith was involved in.
Right. That was neat.
Which actually, interestingly enough, Time Warrior was one of the things I was thinking of when watching Robot of Sherwood.
Yeah, that's funny. True. Well, Blood Axe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention the interesting way that they use nursery rhymes. Now, we have two clips of the nursery rhymes that Peter Capaldi uses while he's in the spaceship. And then I have a Stephen King quote. And it goes like this: the thing under my bed waiting to grab my ankle isn't real. I know that. And I also know that if I'm careful to keep my foot under the covers, it will never be able to grab my ankle. So there's a little bit of Moffat borrowing.
Yeah, I was going to say paying a little bit of homage to Stephen King
at the Master of Horror. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So. But I'd like to, these nursery rhymes, I don't believe, I looked, if someone on our Facebook account or within the whosonpodcast.com email can email us where these nursery rhymes come from, I believe that Moffat is the originator of them, but I'm not entirely sure. I couldn't find them. I'd like to know, if possible.
Yeah, definitely.
Someone knocking. Yes.
Doctor. You don't actually believe all this, do you? Hiding creatures, things from under the bed.
What's that in the mirror or the corner of your eye? What's that footstep following? But never passing by. Perhaps they're all just waiting. Perhaps when we're all dead, out they'll come a slithering from underneath the bed.
I think Capaldi can really deliver that kind of line better than a lot of the other doctors, being the Dark Doctor, I guess, now, because of his voice, because of the accent, because it's not young either.
Well,
it's...
exactly. He has an old voice, like, you know, even... maybe he smoked a lot or something when he was younger, but he's got a gruff...
dropped acid, remember?
Maybe. Oh, yeah. But no, he's got, like, you know, he's got that... Yeah, he's got the gruffness and the kind of creepy... well, actually, and my sister mentioned today, too, that whatever serial he was in leading up to being the Doctor, that he was actually the villain. My sister mentioned that to me just earlier today, so maybe that's part of why he's able to do that whole, like, kind of... bad guy kind of.
Oh, well, there's whole videos of him on YouTube just swearing up a storm, which is very
funny. That's the thick of it.
Yeah,
it's called
the thick of it. Yeah.
political drama where he plays like a spin doctor, essentially.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I think that's what she was talking about.
But yeah, he's known for an extremely foul mouth.
Yeah, it's funny because with the sound of the knocking and everything, it just makes me think again how we were talking about the whole like reasonable explanation for things, even though we want to kind of be creeped out by it, you know. I just loved the whole idea of like when they were saying that, you know, why Danny or why Orson, don't you want to stay here one more night? And like, you know, the whole look on his face of just like the terror of having to be there one more night, putting up with the sounds.
Yeah,
like,
I wanted to mention that too. I'm glad you brought that up, because after 6 months of being alone mm-hmm. in a place like that where you can't open the door but you really desire companionship, what would that do to your mind?
Not only that, yeah, I mean that, and then just
very cogent, very lucid and sane.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the same time, if that's supposed to be in the future, you know, who knows what other kind of like, you know, emotional stabilizing, you know, medicines they would have had for him. I'm just saying, you know,
it's
the way
100
that,
years in
the way
our
that
future,
science,
I believe they said he comes from.
Yeah, it was
from.
About that, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it's funny because when you think about that, you look at the, when they look out the window and you look at the landscape, you can tell that it's kind of like a Mars sort of thing, right? It's very hot, you know, very dry, you know, and you figure if they're walking around in their spaceship all comfortable.
Mars is hot?
I'm assuming so. Considering it's supposed to be dry and there's not really any surface water.
There's extreme temperature shifts.
Yeah, that's kind of, and that's kind of what I'm saying too.
It's so thin.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the thing. You can imagine, like, the sound of metal when it, you know, adjusting to a drastic change in temperature, you know, having it buckle and, you know, the sound of, like, you know, when you think of, like, Titanic and, like, when you know, in the movie Titanic, the sound effects they had of when it ran into the iceberg.
I did not watch that movie.
The metal-on-metal sound. You think of, like, a car crashing and that, like, you just, that whole metal-on-metal sound, you can imagine how if you were by yourself in a spaceship for 6 months and you hear that noise from outside the hull, you're going to, yeah, Dan's in there shaking his head like, no, thank you.
No, I know. When I used to close up shop where I used to work sometimes, there would be nobody else there. And you'd hear the vents opening and closing. Places do settle. And especially like you're saying, that's a very, very good explanation for me, the hot and cold. And it being metal and it being mm-hmm. a hull locked, how it would have to breathe in some way.
Mm-hmm. Not to say that's any less, you know, disturbing. It would definitely be, it would not be comforting, but.
And he refused to say what he saw when he pulled the doctor out. That whole scene was kind of like cut out. We don't get to see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's about to say and is interrupted. Or it seems like he was about to say. But.
Yeah, I have the feeling it's another one of those things where I think the way that Stephen Moffat wrote the episode is that he doesn't want us to know the things that were happening. You know, the old trick of, you know, not letting you see the scary thing under the bed. The whole thing of not letting you know what happened. Because now, that I mean, how much conjecture can we make about, you know, was it really knocking or was there some, you know, was it just settling, you know? Did Orson actually see anything or would he just sit there and say, no, there actually wasn't anything?
Oh, one other thing. Yeah, exactly. One other thing I wanted to mention was that Missy was not in the last two episodes.
Right.
Robot of Sherwood or Listen. And I was having a little think on Missy, too, and I completely forgot that Ramana Viratnalunda is also a Time Lord who would have been in E-Space during the whole times of...
Hmm.
I don't know if she survived or not, because she was in E-Space the last we saw her. But I know that there's Radio Big Finish Audio did some broadcasts, and I believe she has been in stories, so but not television canon.
Right.
So I'm not exactly sure where that would go, because that would have been, I guess, more or less. I don't know. The doctor's still a lot older than Ramana.
Yeah, but at the same time, too, like
the boyfriend girlfriend thing that she mentioned.
Yeah, but not even that. Just I don't know if Missy seems more like a villain to me so far than Ramana
like
would be.
Like a what?
Yeah.
She's like. Makes me think of that Clint Eastwood movie, Play Misty for Me. You know, it's like someone like really, really obsessed with him.
Hmm.
You know, unhealthily obsessed, you know, like.
Yeah, like making up the whole boyfriend thing.
Boyfriend and talking about his accent, how she's going to let him keep it. And, you know, it's definitely, you know, kind of.
She's over-possessive internet girl.
She's like a fan gone wrong.
Yeah, and that's why, like, yeah, and just considering the fact that, I don't know, like, I think of the people that we've seen that she's saved so far, and, like, you have to wonder, how many other people has she saved? You know, how long does she know she's a Time Lord? We're assuming that she's a Time Lord. You know, considering all of the history, how many other people has she actually saved? Who knows? Maybe at some point Matthew Waterhouse is going to show up.
Oh,
and she's going to be like, hey, what do you know? After you did this thing, I jumped in there, grabbed him.
For those who don't know, Matthew Waterhouse played Adric, and he died in one of the most... there was no Doctor Who theme played at the end of the episode. It was Earthshock.
Yep.
And he flew a cyber ship into the Earth, which was apparently the way the dinosaurs passed away.
Mm-hmm. Sacrificed himself to save the Doctor and the other companions, though.
Yeah.
And so his last line is, I guess I'll never know if I was right.
Mm-hmm.
So if he were to come back, then maybe we would find out if he was right or not. Then I think it'll happen. But.
No, I mean, I was just throwing that out just to be facetious. Yeah. But no, but it's just the point too, though. But who knows, you know, these two people that were basically nobodies. I mean, you know, the half-faced android man and this Gretchen something or other whose name
Carlisle.
We're supposed to remember and we can't remember.
Gretchen Carlisle. Yeah. I don't remember the middle name.
But and it's just, I almost got to wonder if maybe Stephen left. Stephen, I'm like, I'm on a first name basis with him.
Steve.
We feel better about him after this week. So, you know, all of a sudden we're close
and
with
Clara.
Him.
Clara did a great job.
Yeah, no, I...
Because she was separated from the Doctor.
And that's the thing, again, where with the, after I watched this episode, see, now we're picking little things apart, but when the episode was done, I didn't care about the things that I could have... that I would usually have poked holes... and that
well, neither either. Myself. Because the story was so well done.
Uh-huh. And the way it was concluded, that's the thing. I was done. I turned off my Roku, I turned off the TV, and I turned off the little media streaming computer that I have, and I had a little smile on my face. I turned it off, and I went, and I sat and read a book. I was very, very happy with it. You know, I literally had nothing to say as soon as it was done.
What book did you read?
Makers by Cory Doctorow.
I have no idea.
It's okay. He's a very information digital freedom fighter kind of guy, and he's
It's not like a fantasy or fiction kind of thing.
It's fiction based. It's fiction based on, like, I guess technically science fiction in a sense, but not like being in space science fiction, but like, you know, stuff about information and like particularly this book is actually about. I'm going to turn this into a Dr. O presentation thing, but that's okay. He won't mind. I'll just tag him on Facebook or something or Twitter. But no, it's actually about just people using like 3D printers, being inventive and stuff like that. And
well, the Daleks, you know, we mentioned the Daleks use 3D printers to build their cities.
There you go. So so it does actually play into Dr. O anyway. But it's basically just this
Dr. O?
Dr. O. Dr. O.W. Dr. O.
Dr. Owl.
Dr. Owl. See, that's the correct pronunciation.
Yeah, maybe it is. Yeah.
What did you do after watching this episode, Dan? Did you sit did you sit at your bed and just keep your ankles down?
The thing about my bed is on the floor. Oh. I've been sleeping on a bed on the floor for about 10 years now.
A lot of people do that. There's like a whole futon generation that just...
Yeah.
Yeah, box spring
and a mattress on the floor. And I've been doing that, you know, like more than 10 years, maybe 12 years now.
So but 2 years goes by like that.
Bed frame.
Right? 2 years goes by like that for you? It's pretty recent. For those of you who don't know, Dan.
Only when it comes to Doctor Who.
Oh, okay. Dan mentioned how he just watched something, and I said it was about 2 years ago. Anyway, this was not a romp. This was absolute brilliance. This was dark, brooding.
Mm-hmm.
The ambience that Dan had mentioned was perfect. The tempo was good. Even with the 45 minutes, I thought the story could breathe. This got 5 out of 5 TARDISes mm-hmm. for me.
Absolutely.
So, Moffat, yeah. you really you can be happy. You hang your hat on the Who's On Boys approval.
There you go. Exactly.
Like we matter.
But, seal of approval.
Yeah. Stamp an American flag on that one. Hoorah.
America.
America. So there you go. Steven, very good. Or Steve, as
Steve,
Rob knows you.
Now that we've allowed you into the huddle, Steve.
And I just hope that today's episode will continue the brilliance. Do you know who wrote today's episode, Dan?
I believe it was written by Steve Thompson.
Steve
Moffat, Steve Thompson.
Yeah, keep it in the Steve family.
Hey,
I'm looking.
Bruce,
here.
Your name is Steve, that's gonna come
yeah,
up.
Stephen Thompson, who he wrote The Curse of the Black Spot and Journey to the Center of the TARDIS.
Okay.
And he's one of the main writers for the Moffat's other show, Sherlock.
Hmm. All right.
He's
well,
one of the three
hope,
main writers
hope,
between Moffat and Mark Gatiss.
I hope it's good.
We'll see.
Yeah, until then, folks, Whovians, Nuvians, time travelers, we've enjoyed this. I hope you have too. Take care.